From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate will take up a bill to fund the government later today, with the House to follow soon after. While unhappy with it, the president has hinted he will sign it, which would avert another government shutdown, so we'll be following that. And there's other big news out of Washington. The federal judge overseeing a trial of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort ruled that he lied to investigators, including about his contact with a Russian. That breaks his plea agreement and could result in a more severe sentence. We're joined now by NPR justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And give us some context here, because we know last summer Paul Manafort was convicted by a jury in Virginia of tax evasion, bank fraud, other crimes. This is separate. This was a plea deal he made with prosecutors in the Mueller investigation into Russia's involvement with the 2016 election. What was the agreement, and how did prosecutors say that he broke it?
Well, both trials. The trial in Virginia was prosecuted by folks from the Mueller team. Then there was the separate case in district court in Washington, D.C. Manafort pleaded guilty to two conspiracy charges on the eve of his trial there. That was back in September. Now, what the judge determined that Manafort ended up lying about, which ultimately blew up his plea deal, were three things. One, a payment to a law firm. She also determined that he made false statements relevant to another Justice Department investigation. And then, perhaps most importantly and interesting for us, he lied about interactions and communications that he had with a business associate by the name of Konstantin Kilimnik. Now, Kilimnik is someone that the FBI says has a relationship with Russian intelligence services, and what they discussed in a number of meetings, Kilimnik and Manafort did, was a peace plan for Ukraine, which is something that is very central for Russian foreign policy. And then two, Manafort also allegedly shared polling data with Kilimnik. We don't have a lot of details on that, but it's something that Judge Amy Berman Jackson here in D.C. determined was something of note, and that Manafort did intentionally lie about it.
Well, we understand that the two men reportedly talked about a proposal to, as you say, resolve the conflict in Ukraine, but also maybe give Moscow relief from the American sanctions?
Well, that's something that has been a key tenet of Russian foreign policy regarding the United States, is getting out from under those sanctions related to their work in Ukraine.
Yeah. What is going on here? Because there's a lot of speculation that lying, his behavior, might indicate that he's angling for a presidential pardon. Adam Schiff, the Democratic chair of the House Intelligence Committee, said he may have lied to further protect President Trump. Your thoughts?
Well, Schiff is the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Certainly, Schiff, politically speaking, would be more inclined to view this perhaps through that lens. There is reason to, well, certainly there have been discussions about a possible pardon. Rudy Giuliani said that it came up back when Manafort's trial in Virginia was going on. He has since said that the president agreed not to discuss pardons or look at pardons while the special counsel's investigation is still going on. But then in November, the president himself said, when asked by the New York Post whether he would consider a pardon for Paul Manafort, the president refused to take that question off the table, which means it continues to kind of hover over all discussions of Paul Manafort.
Yeah. Look, the Senate's going to vote today on the confirmation of William Barr to be attorney general. This would be his second time leading the Department of Justice. But how does that fit into this picture and the Mueller investigation?
Well, Barr's confirmation vote is supposed to take place in the within the hour. Now, Barr is someone that Democrats wanted to try to pin down and get to say that, yes, he would agree to release the final report that Mueller comes up with at the end of his investigation. Now, what Barr has said on the record is that he will not interfere in Mueller's investigation. The two men have known each other for years. Barr says that they are friends. But again, the question that remains is whether, well, what Barr will do with the final report that Mueller comes up with. He has said that he would like to make as much of it public as he can, but he has not provided that ultimate guarantee, that promise that Democrats were looking for, which is that he will release the report in its entirety. So that is the question that hangs over Barr as he most likely will win confirmation.
And, Ryan, we only have a few seconds here. Sorry to do this to you, but Manafort, by all accounts, looked like heck in court. What kind of time might he be facing?
Well, it's not entirely clear. He needs to be sentenced in Virginia. He could face around 10 years there. And then in the D.C. case, it's up to the judge what to do.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the CDC says there have been at least 101 individual cases of measles in 10 states, including Washington State, where the health department reports at least 54 confirmed cases. That outbreak has sparked a debate about requiring vaccinations. And a Republican lawmaker in Clark County, Washington, is sponsoring a bill that would tighten restrictions on vaccination exemptions there. State Representative Paul Harris joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, great. Thank you for the invite.
And first of all, before we get to your solution to this, what is the situation where you are with this outbreak at this point? Do you feel that it's under control?
Well, it's not completely in control, but it has slowed down. We're at about 52 cases of the measles in my area, and the last case hadn't been out among the public, so that's good news. And yeah, I think we're getting to a sense where we feel like we're getting more control of it.
Do you think that the reason for the outbreak is that some have not been vaccinated, and that if they were vaccinated, that this wouldn't have happened?
Absolutely. I mean, the actual strain came from over in Europe, but if the individuals had been vaccinated, then we wouldn't be facing what we're facing today. That is correct. If they had been vaccinated, this wouldn't have been a problem.
So you have proposed a bill. What would it do exactly?
Well, what the bill does is it gets rid of the personal exemption in our state. It's the number one exemption used by children in our schools. So there's three exemptions. One is personal or philosophical. The second is religious. And the third is medical. This bill will just deal with the personal or philosophical. So basically, if you philosophically or personally are opposed to vaccinations or just don't like them, you can opt out. And this would get rid of that exemption. If they have a religious exemption, they can declare that and it will be honored.
And a similar bill failed a few years ago. Do you think this one will pass?
Yeah, well, this is a little different. So this only gets rid of the personal exemption for measles, mumps, and rubella. So just the one vaccine. It's the most contagious. It's the most difficult to contain. So the bill a couple of years ago got rid of all personal exemptions for all vaccines. Mm-hmm. This one just does the one. And I think we'll have good results this time. I really do.
Do you think minds have been changed after what you've been through just now with this outbreak?
Yeah, I think it's really gotten their attention. And I guess the only good news out of this is we've seen vaccination rates in Clark County go up five times fold, where we were averaging about 200 a week. We're at 1,000 a week now. So the opposition, those that really felt like plenty of kids were immunized, that can't be the case because we have a lot of kids getting immunized right now because of this outbreak, which is good, but it's not the way it should happen. They should have had the vaccination before we have the disease in the area.
I want to read you a tweet because this has gotten political as this outbreak has gone on. And this is a tweet from Darla Shine, who's the wife of the White House Communications Director Bill Shine, tweeted this in response to a measles outbreak story on CNN. She said, hashtag fake, hashtag hysteria. The entire baby boom population alive today had the measles as kids. Bring back our childhood diseases. They keep you healthy and fight cancer. What do you think of that?
Wow. Well, I guess what I would like to hashtag them is to say, over in Europe, there's been 82,000 cases of measles in the last couple of years, and about 120 people have died from the measles in Europe. We do not want these diseases back in our environment. And I think the idea that just to say, because some of us were fortunate enough and didn't die from these diseases, if we go back into our history, 500 to 700 people a year we're dying from the measles. So I don't think it's hysteria. I just think it's something that's very controllable. We could avoid this if we would just have been vaccinated. So why would we go through this?
Why do you think there are so many people where you are in the Pacific Northwest who are anti-vaccine?
I think there's a lot of information that floats around on the internet. I think there was a report years ago by a doctor on autism that said that the cause of autism was because of vaccines. And I think a lot of these studies have been debunked. But who I would like people to go to is to their primary care physician. Sit down with a doctor that you trust, that you've gone to for your family's medical history and when you're in difficult times with health. Sit down and talk to your doctor about vaccinations and get well informed from a professional.
So you're confident your bill will pass. How soon do you think that can happen? When will it be law?
Well, as I say, no law becomes a law by accident here. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty confident, though. We've heard the bill, heard the initial hearing on it. We will vote on it either today or Friday. Then it will go to the House floor, and we will vote on it. And then we'll go over to the Senate, and it goes through the same process. It has the votes in committee. I'm pretty confident it has the votes on the House floor. I sit on the Rules Committee. I will pull the bill out of Rules, and we'll have a vote on the House floor. And, yeah, hopefully this will proceed through the process and become law, and more kids will be safe in our state.
That is Washington State Representative Republican Paul Harris talking to us about the measles outbreak in his state and the bill that he's introduced to address it. Representative, thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
So what do you think? Should there be a law that requires people to be vaccinated or at least removes exemptions? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
When 14 students and three staffers were slaughtered by a gunman at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, a year ago today, hundreds more students joined a terrible club, survivors of a school shooting. And waiting for them there, survivors of the Columbine shooting. Nearly 20 years ago, two young men killed 13, wounded more than 200, and terrorized a community in what was then the worst high school shooting in U.S. history in Columbine, Colorado. Now some of the Columbine survivors have been helping the Parkland kids. Amy Over is a part of that. She's now 38, a mother of two in Colorado. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, because I'm imagining this is the anniversary of another school shooting. It's another group of kids. But I'm wondering if it hits you as well.
It definitely hits me as well. I was 18 years old when I went through my shooting. And as a mother of two now, it definitely hits me really hard.
Yeah. It's interesting because in reading a lot of the Columbine survivors' accounts, they say that therapists at the time told you that down the road, you know, when you have kids, you're going to get triggered again.
That has definitely happened. It's been a long journey. Mm. So I've gone through phases where I have, you know, had to find out how I cope. I really struggled when I became a mom, and when my daughter started school is when I had my first panic attack. I had to go back to therapy because I essentially just was re-traumatized, and I was afraid that this was going to happen again to my child.
Oh, just a cautionary tale to mm-hmm. the Parkland students, you know, and I know some of you from Columbine have been reaching out to them. We want to talk about that as well. But
definitely,
to get across what this means, I mean, panic attack. Some people might think, oh, your heart fluttered. Is this the day that you dropped your child off at preschool?
Yes, it was the first day I dropped my daughter off at preschool. And it's supposed to be an exciting, happy time. All the parents are taking pictures of their backpacks. And I'm literally having a horrible panic attack and almost collapsed. I ended up going straight to the hospital.
People thought you were having a heart attack.
I thought I was dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought I was literally dying.
And the doctor says to you, you know, could anything have caused this?
Yeah, I was like, well, I just dropped my daughter off at school and I'm a Columbine survivor. And he was like, well, I think you're having a panic attack.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can laugh about it now, but it was a really dark time in my life and embarrassing because, you know, at that point I was almost 10 years out of my shooting and I was thinking, why am I still struggling?
Yeah. I mean, people who talk about triggers, that's become sort of such a cliche, but it's a real thing. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, you couldn't have stopped that if you had wanted to. What is it? Is it like ice in your veins? Like what is it?
It just feels awful. Like if a car backfires or 4th of July, as a survivor, it's kind of like just an awful time.
You mentioned car backfire, and another time you were with another Columbine survivor, a friend, and you're in a parking garage and a car backfires. And what'd you guys do?
We dropped to the ground. We literally both just fell to the ground.
Yeah.
And we laughed about it. We were like, wow, 19 years out of our shooting and look what we're doing.
Yeah. Look, we don't want to go anywhere that might cause you that discomfort again. But can you tell us what happened that day almost 20
Definitely.
Years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a senior in high school about to graduate. I was just getting ready to play basketball at a junior college, so kind of felt like my life was on track. Mm-hmm. And said goodbye to my basketball coach, Dave Sanders. He's the one that passed away. Mm-hmm. Went to a few classes and came down for lunch, and that's when the shooting started. Luckily, I saw my coach, and he kind of told us to get away from the windows.
You know, Columbine started outside. All of you could hear it, this outside, mm-hmm. and he told you to get away from the windows?
He told us to get away from the windows and get down. Yeah. He essentially saved my life, saved hundreds of kids' lives that day, thousands of kids' lives. Mm-hmm. As soon as I saw my coach tell us to run, because one of the gunmen were coming in, the other one was outside shooting at us as we ran out.
Mm. It's a nightmare. You know,
it is a nightmare, and I can't imagine what my mom... I do remember calling her and saying there was a shooting at the school and I was okay. And then I hung up. Mm-hmm. So my poor mom just can't imagine what she went through.
Well, you can now, you know,
yeah.
because two children, one daughter's a teen, they're having lockdown drills.
Yes.
Does she know?
She does. I shared with her about my tragedy when she was 11 years old. During one of the anniversaries, I shared with her. She had a lot of questions, and I felt like that was the appropriate age to share that with her. Now, I didn't go into detail as to, you know, what I saw or anything, but I did tell her that I was in a shooting, and I showed her, you know, where I was that day. Mm-hmm. And she's just a big part of that day for me now. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a day of healing and a day of peace for my family.
In April.
So,
well, you're also, as we said, part of this horrible but noble, you know, wonderful in many ways club.
Yes.
Of survivors. And you're part of something called the Rebels Project, formed by Columbine survivors after the Aurora Theater shooting, two horrendous shootings in Colorado. You were Columbine survivors reaching out to Aurora Theater survivors, now to Parkland. And they're looking. They've seen things you've said.
A few Parkland kiddos have reached out to me and have just said, you know, I've seen some of your other pieces that you've done, and especially like with your daughter, and thank you. And they've reached out about some of their phases they're going through right now.
What do you want them to know?
I just want them to know that there is a huge support system out there for them when they're ready to embark on that journey. I want them to take care of themselves. I know that sometimes you think you're okay for years, but eventually if you don't deal with it, it's going to come rear its ugly head. So someday you're going to have to deal with this. It's just a hard, I can't believe it's been a year. Mm-hmm. Their pain that they've endured is too much.
Well, but I'm hearing you, Amy Over, and I'm thinking you're mid-30s, but to many of us, you're still that kid from Columbine. I mean, we feel the same way about you.
But it's not all negative. I've got to meet amazing people, and especially working with the Rebels Project, I've got to help a lot of people. So that gives me hope. That gives me just power to just get through this, you know. I mean, this is it. This is my life, and this was the cards that I've been dealt, and I just want to help others, especially in their mental health journey.
I want to add one other thing to that, because we're reading about some of your fellow survivors. Austin Eubanks, his best friend next to him was killed. He was shot. He was prescribed opiates. He became an addict. Who would think of these side effects? Spent years getting over that addiction. And one of the things he wants to tell Parkland students is, you know, go for it. It's amazing. They have these social media platforms and they have created these lives, many of them, of activism. But his message is, don't get so fully consumed with your activism that you detach from your healing.
He hit it perfect. Exactly. Just as a mom, even if I wasn't in a mass shooting, I just would tell them to take care of yourself. And this is a lifelong adventure, lifelong journey, a lifelong thing you're going to have to deal with. I love their activism. I do. I wish that I had one Parkland kid ask me when I was working with them last year, why didn't you fight? And I told him, I said, we didn't know to fight. It was one of the first mass shootings, so we didn't know to be activists. We didn't have the social media platforms. I told him, I was like, I had a pager. I was like, and he's like, what's a pager? I didn't know to fight. So I said, we pretty much wanted everyone to leave us alone. The media encroached on our privacy. It was very publicized. It was really exhausting and very difficult with, you know, cameras in your face all the time. We didn't want that light shined on us at that time.
I can hear what you were saying, that you wish you'd stepped up on. I'm gathering maybe on issues of mental health and guns and those issues that the Parkland kids are taking up. It feels to me like there must be such a feeling of love between you and them. And we know there's parents who've lost children who fly in to these scenes right after they happen. I can't even imagine that feeling that you have for each other.
It's a beautiful thing when you meet another survivor. And I'll get emotional right now, because when you finally meet somebody that gets you and understands exactly what you've gone through, there's so much power in that. It's just so powerful when you get to hug another survivor.
Amy Over, a survivor of the Columbine shootings and director of fundraising for the Rebels Project.
Yes.
How sad that it's grown. How wonderful, though, for the people who need it. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Football fans are wandering the landscape, unmoored in a post-Super Bowl malaise, nothing to watch. But hold on, the Alliance of American Football is throwing a lifeline. The new league is heading into its second weekend of games. 8 teams, including the Arizona Hotshots, the Atlanta Legends, the San Diego Fleet. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Did you like that image?
I like how you set that up. Those are the stakes, yes. And by the way, I was unhappy and unmoored during the Super Bowl, as were most football fans.
Yeah, but what do you think of this new league? Because NFL bigwigs apparently were skeptical, but they came away impressed, at least according to USA Today.
Yes, I would say the level of play was described as what you'd get in the second half of a preseason game, but that's not terrible. It's a bunch of guys who aren't in the NFL for a reason, although some of them probably could be. And I understand from the NFL's perspective why they would like a league like this to exist, because there's not a lot of great ways to see potentially talented players when you're watching in college. They're not playing against great players, and they're not playing in, you know, pro-style offenses. So it would be good for them. They shouldn't see this league as a competitor. They should see it as essentially like a quasi-farm system or a feeder system that they don't have to pay for.
Yeah,
so that's
isn't it necessary? I mean, we're at a time when we're talking about, even if you love football, there's a recognition, you know, kids aren't playing as much because of the injuries. I mean, is expansion the right way to go?
This is a great point, and it's why I am conflicted, why I am literally ambivalent. If this were a baseball league or another kind of hockey league, which exist, and they exist for a reason, minor leagues and unaffiliated leagues, it'd be fine. It'd be great, you know, giving fans more of the sport they want with a little bit of a lower temperature, lower ticket prices in some different cities. All that's for the good. But as you mentioned, football, it's very hard to say that more football on this earth or in America is an unalloyed good thing. I will say this, though. Of all the levels of football or ways to convince me that football could be okay. Professional, informed adults getting paid to play football, that is the least bad form of football, whereas I think something like college football, essentially indentured servitude in the service of football, that might be the most bad form of football. And that's right now what the feeder system is.
Yeah. Okay, we got a minute. The AAF has an app. It allows fans to follow games with these visualizations. The league founder, Charlie Ebersole, son of Dick Ebersole, calls it Madden versus Angry Birds. He says that's what it looks like. Is that going to push the thing forward?
They do have innovations. They will, for instance, you can listen in as referees make decisions. That's interesting. I bet you that whether this fails or exists as an ongoing enterprise, and maybe the best they could hope for is one day some of their teams get absorbed, but I bet they influence the NFL. I bet at least with the presentation of it, and this happened with the USFL, and it definitely happened with the XFL, two failed leagues that influence the NFL and nudge the NFL forward in terms of being a more innovative way to experience the game. This new league is going to do that.
Mike Pesca, Here Now, is a sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, talking about the Alliance of American Football.
Yes.
We'll see if, you know, if we're talking about it in the future. Mike, thank you.
Yes. Go Memphis Express.
Venezuela's opposition leader and self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido says he'll open a humanitarian corridor into Venezuela by February 23rd, raising the stakes in the fight over who is the country's legitimate president. That fight now centers on a shipment of aid sent by the Trump administration, which supports Guaido's claim to power. Nicolas Maduro's government has refused the aid, creating a standoff at the border with Colombia and heightening tensions in the country's political crisis. Tamir Poras joins us now on Skype. He was chief of staff to Maduro until 2013 and an advisor to former President Hugo Chavez. He's now a visiting professor at Sciences Po. You write in The Guardian that the recognition of Guaido by the U.S. as Venezuela's interim president risks a bloody civil war. Why?
Well, the recognition of Guaido is motivated on what I believe to be weak assumptions. One is there is a policy or a decision from the Trump administration that there must be a regime change in Venezuela that ignores the fact that Venezuela has been very divided politically during the last few years. And second, that the U.S. administration has very explicitly said that they are willing to use force to accelerate this regime change. So if that transition doesn't happen automatically, what will be the next move?
Well, so then what would you suggest that the U.S. and other countries, by the way, do in this situation? They're watching, you know, hundreds of people dealing with starvation because of food shortages. They're watching the economy collapse. Millions of people, according to the United Nations, have fled Venezuela in the last few years. What is the rest of the world supposed to do? Just stand back and allow things to continue as they are, or what?
Well, first of all, if the internal situation of Venezuela has to be dealt with by the international community, they have to do so within the framework of international law. Secondly, it also needs to take into consideration the internal political situation of the country. So the international community, for instance, should acknowledge that the Venezuelan society is deeply divided and then should help Venezuelans and the different factions within Venezuela to reach a political agreement that guarantees that whatever the outcome of the crisis, the country will remain peaceful, the political system will be democratic, and that the Venezuelan society will be in conditions to address its very deep problems. Today, Venezuela is facing a deep economic crisis that has generated this social deep social problem that has motivated people to leave the country, but that solution cannot be reached and that problem cannot be addressed if the country does not find a stable and democratic solution to the crisis.
But many of the people, including Mr. Guaido, have said that the democratic process is not working, that the election, the last election of Maduro, was not legitimate.
The reason for that claim is that the opposition that Mr. Guaido now represents and the government were unable to reach a political agreement that created conditions for both parties to agree to participate in an election. So the core problem, the reason for the election being considered illegitimate, is that most of the opposition parties did not participate. So again, the root of the problem is the absence of a political agreement internally in Venezuela. So recognizing Mr. Guaido today is taking sides with Venezuelan opposition, ignoring the fact that the government, Chavismo, the armed forces have a strong influence within the country, and again, that problem is not solved. So once again, if you increase the pressure, the risk of a conflict within the country increases also.
And by the way, when you use the term Chavismo, this is the ideology that is based on the ideas of the former Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, who you were an advisor to. Let me ask you about the immediate situation, which is this aid that the U.S. says it is trying to send in, and that the Maduro government has set up a blockade of it. They're saying that this is a pretext for invasion. What do you think should happen with that aid that Guaido says is coming in and that he wants released to the people, but that Maduro is blocking?
First, let's talk about the facts. Mr. Guaido self-proclaims president on January 23rd. Then the U.S. administration recognizes Guaido. Then Guaido asks the U.S. to send that aid of worth $20 million. And the Trump administration, which perceives the Maduro administration as an enemy, sends this aid to the borders of Venezuela. So you understand that this is a political move. The U.N. and the International Red Cross have stated very clearly that, again, humanitarian action should be separate from political goals. So this is not a discussion on, you know, whether Venezuela requires international assistance. Is the way this assistance or so-called assistance is being proposed by the Trump administration that makes policy to facilitate or generate a regime change in Venezuela. That's the reason why we have reached this point.
So you think that Maduro is right to block the aid?
I'm not saying that he's right to block it. I'm explaining the reasons why he is blocking it. Just days before deciding sending this aid, the U.S. administration, in a hostile move to Maduro's government in Venezuela, seized oil-related assets worth billions of dollars in Venezuela. So again, the Trump administration is sending help to Venezuela worth $20 million. And at the same time, they have blocked oil assets and oil revenues worth billions of dollars. So once again, they are also making that argument. I'm not defending the fact that Venezuela does not need help. I'm just explaining that the political framework within which this aid is being sent to Venezuela has political implications, and the explanation why the Maduro administration is blocking it is the one that I have given you.
As we said, you were the chief of staff to Nicolas Maduro until 2013. This is before he became the president of Venezuela. Yeah. But if you listen to the critics of Maduro, you would think that he is somebody who just refuses to give up his power, somebody who's willing to see his people starve, somebody who's willing to see the economy collapse to hold on to power, and somebody who is using some of the oil revenues of Venezuela to pay off people to support him. Is any of that true in your view, or what do you think?
Well, I have been myself a critic of Maduro's rule. So again, I here stand from the perspective of a Chavista who served under President Hugo Chavez and who has disagreed deeply with President Maduro's rule. There is absolutely lots of critics concerning his, you know, approach to the country's economy, the way the oil revenues have been used, etc. But again, this dramatic move from the opposition, self-proclaiming president, seeking international recognition, in my opinion, raises the danger of a parallel state, you know, emerging in Venezuela, the institutions of Venezuela being split. We see how it has worked out. For instance, in a different geography, but in the case of Libya, for instance, where the state was divided, in the case of Iraq, for instance, where after the invasion, again, the state was dismantled, we have seen how those societies have become chaotic. How the political problems, internal political problems that weren't addressed before the international community made very, very radical moves and even decided on the use of military force, we have seen that those countries have not found stability, have not been able to organize democratically. So again, in the case of Venezuela, a more intelligent, pragmatic way of addressing the problem, whatever the political stance is understanding that this is a very divided society and that needs all political factions, whether we agree with them or not, to reach political agreement. And the main efforts of the international community should be focused on that goal.
You're joining us from Paris today. Do you have hope that your country will return to stability, that Venezuela will return to stability?
Absolutely. I do have hope. But again, I can only, one, advocate for restraint, moderation, instead of pushing for a more dramatic and eventually violent outcome to this crisis.
That is Tamir Poras, who was a chief of staff to the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro before he was president. He's now a visiting professor at Sciences Po in Paris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Just a couple of generations ago, the words "I love you" dominated song titles and lyrics, and sales would spike right around now, Valentine's Day. These days, "I love you" has all but disappeared from chart toppers that have gone from sweet to cynical. Reporter Judith Kogan tells us why.
When Bing Crosby sang Cole Porter's "I Love You" back in 1944, love seemed pretty straightforward. It involved two people, the first powerfully drawn to the second.
I love you. That's the song of songs.
15 years later, English pretty boy Cliff Richard sang a song by the same name. Electric guitars and drums had replaced soaring strings, but the sentiment was roughly the same.
Your love means more to me than all the apples hanging on a tree. And like the apples, a love will grow because I love you.
To catch on, a song needs to feel fresh. And so in the decades that followed, the phrase "I love you" got dressed up in more outfits than you'd find in a Kardashian closet.
Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name?
McCartney called that last one "silly love song," but like the others, it was an instant hit. Songs reflect the times in which they're written, not just the moment in the evolution of song, but the zeitgeist. And recent hits with the word "love" in the title have turned from sweet to snarky.
Now I think the most romantic songs there are come with a bit of sort of world-weary wisdom.
That's Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money.
I mean, look at, like, you know, Beyoncé's Lemonade, which is, I think, probably the greatest love album of the last decade. But it was about digging deep and going through crap together.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up.
There have always been songs about heartbreak and hurt. But now they come with a defiant edge that says, I'm not going to let you bring me down. Self-empowerment is the opposite of romantic surrender. Another reason "I love you" rarely shows up in hit song titles these days: changes in the recording industry. Songs used to be written in isolation. Songwriters would churn out a tune with no idea who, if anyone, would be singing it.
As the music industry has evolved over the past 50 or so years, it's become increasingly more likely that an artist is actually going to show up and be involved in the writing of the song with some professional writers.
That's songwriter Ben Camp, who teaches at Berklee College of Music in Boston.
So now we're in a situation where you're not just writing a generic love song and sending it off and hoping that the label's going to hear it and say, oh, we've got the perfect artist for this. But you're, in fact, in the room with the person that wants to get something off their chest and get it into song. And usually, if you ask somebody, what do they have to get off their chest, is probably not going to be a proclaiming of how wonderful love is and how beautiful everything is going in their life.
Attracts us to a song is its relatability. The more personal the song, the more the artist opens up and shares, the more we feel it. But while writing these very personal and specific songs, the creative team's main goal is to create a mega hit. And to accomplish that, the music industry is very conservative, tracking recent successes as key to the next.
The entire music industry is constantly playing a game of catch-up with itself. So everybody puts out something until something sticks. And then we got a new song, like I'm So Sick of the Same Old Love, and all of a sudden, hating on love becomes a popular theme. So now everybody's in the writing rooms with the artists trying to write hating on love songs because that's what's working right now. And that keeps going until somebody does something different enough that it stands out and then the game starts all over again.
As cultures evolve, they often circle back to earlier norms. And if cynicism and self-involvement give way to declaring in song what we continue to declare in private, will there be a resurgence of hit songs with I Love You in the title? Anna Sale raises an inherent challenge.
A lot of the song titles with love in the title, the really simple ones, have been taken.
But it's been so many years, maybe we can start all over. For Here and Now, I'm Judith Kogan.
Okay, that's a good one. But Jeremy, I think we're old school. A favorite love song?
I'm going to go with Can't Help Falling in Love, Elvis Presley.
Oh, yes. Billy Joel, Just the Way You Are. Roberta Flack, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. Anything by Adele? Your thoughts? Welcome. HereAndNow.org. It's Here and Now. I was too strong. You were trembling.